It is with the most profound trepidation that I venture the thoughts that follow. Although I have tried to absorb a portion of the voluminous contemporary literature on the Trinity, I am keenly aware that I have fallen well short of an appreciation of the myriad subtleties that beset the topic. Worse, there are excellent inductive reasons for thinking that everything I shall say here has been said, and said better, by others, and, by still others, soundly refuted. I have, however, reached a stage in my philosophical life in which I feel compelled to clarify my own thoughts on particular topics in metaphysics. So what I have to say here, in addition to being unenlightening to most of you, will have an air of self-indulgence. For all this, I beg your forgiveness. Okay, and if you don't agree with me, I'll throw you out. Yeah, right. No, I'll have somebody else do it and pay the legal fees. One avoidable impression of an outsider encountering disputes concerning the metaphysics of the Trinity is that disputants seem trapped between Scylla, a robust account of the three persons of the Trinity, which threatens polytheism, and Charybdis, minimizing threeness, which risks undercutting the idea that there really are three persons. So there's this tension. It's hard not to conclude that the situation is hopeless. The Trinity is a mystery not susceptible to metaphysical domestication. And indeed, I think this is so. Nevertheless, I propose to sketch a line of inquiry that might, if nothing else, sharpen the difficulty. In doing so, I am going to appeal not to the kinds of maneuver popular today. I mean, when I read this stuff, it's the same stuff over and over and over. And that's what we don't want in the journal, by the way. Okay? So I'm going to appeal not to the kinds of maneuver popular today with philosophers engaged in analytic metaphysics, but to metaphysical categories at home among the late scholastics and early moderns, in particular, Suarez, Descartes, and especially Spinoza, ironically, I suppose. One aspect of the discussions of the Trinity that I have been unable to master is the nature and extent of constraints on the metaphysical options. Thus, Michael Ray, in a useful discussion of attempts of philosophers to explicate the Trinity, suggests that orthodoxy requires that the persons of the Trinity are substances, that they be substances, not modes. Modalism is a heresy, he says, because modalism downgrades the persons of the Trinity to mere properties. More generally, in providing an account of the Trinity, are we constrained by metaphysical positions held by, or at least available to, philosophers and theologians in the 4th or 5th century? Are we restricted to Aristotelianism as it was then understood, or Neoplatonism? If these philosophers theologians held that persons are substances, is this definitive of the Trinity so that its rejection is heretical? Or is this simply their attempt to provide an account of the metaphysics of a doctrine, the metaphysics of which is dramatically underdetermined? You tell me. As a preliminary, I should note that I will speak of the persons of the Trinity as persons, not selves. I am aware that some distinguish selves from persons and that this distinction could turn out to be momentous, but I myself am not sure what to make of it, so I will not invoke the distinction in what follows. There is a handout. And I discovered to my heart. So I originally had the Nicene Creed here, but after reading Ray and Brouwer and all these other people, I thought, oh, that's so uncool. I should not have the Nicene Creed, but I should have the Creed of Saint. I should have the Athanasian Creed. So I substituted it at the last minute and sent Martin the correction. I now see that I should have left the old familiar Nicene Creed in there. It doesn't matter. The first two items on the handout are just there, okay? They're just ones that speak to the issue. They're not ones I'm going to discuss. My starting point will be Descartes' ontology of substances, attributes, and modes. Kinds of substance are distinguished by their respective attributes. Material substances are extended, for instance, and non-material substances think, where the attribute of thought is best understood as including conscious states generally. So you could think of, instead of thinking substances, you could think of conscious substances if you liked. A substance is not simply extended or conscious, however. A substance must be extended or conscious in particular ways. These ways are modes. A material body's shape or size, for instance, are ways it is extended. Your thinking of Vienna or wanting to leave the room are modes of thought or consciousness, ways of being conscious. Descartes holds that there are just these two kinds of substance, extended substances and thinking substances. You are a thinking substance, intimately united with a particular extended substance, your body. In fact, it is possible that Descartes believed that there is but one extended substance, space itself. What we regard ordinarily as extended bodies, your body, for example, or a tomato or the table or the planets, what we think of as extended substances are really thickenings or eddies, wave-like disturbances of the extended substance. Although I am partial to this interpretation, I will not insist on it here. For present purposes, the important point is that Descartes regards persons as individual substances. If three distinct persons are thinking of Vienna, three distinct substances are doing the thinking. So Descartes was put on the index because of his views on transubstantiation, but five minutes worth of thought would see that he also is going to have problems with the Trinity. But as far as I know, I don't think Arnaud raised questions about the Trinity. I could be wrong about that. Maybe I'm wrong. Extension and thought are attributes that demarcate kinds of substance. It is tempting to think of attributes as determinable properties belonging to substances and modes as determinants of these determinables, but this is not Descartes' view. A substance does not have or possess an attribute in the way a tomato might be said to have a color or a shape. Attributes do not inhere in substances. A substance is its attribute. An extended body, for instance, is its extension. But again, nothing can be extended simpliciter. An extended body must be extended in a definite way or ways, the spherical way, the red way. A thinking substance must think particular thoughts, must think in this or that way. These ways are modes, modes of extension, modes of thought. So substances are their attributes, and what we would think of as properties of substances are modes, ways of being so attributed. Substances, attributes, and modes alike are particulars. Modes are abstract particulars, not abstract in the peculiar 20th century sense of being non-spatio-temporal, but in the traditional sense of being dependent on the substances of which they are modes, substances they modify. None of the philosophers I shall be discussing regarded properties as universals. Modes are unshareable. If two tomatoes are red, their individual rednesses are numerically distinct. Nowadays, properties thus regarded are labeled tropes, a term originally introduced in the 1950s, not without irony, by D.C. Williams in the course of developing a bundle theory of substances. According to Williams, a substance is having a property as a matter of the properties being a part, a mereological part of the substance. This makes substances dependent on their properties in the way collections or sets are dependent on their members. Modes, in contrast, are not parts of substances. A simple substance, an entity lacking substantial parts, parts that are themselves substances, could possess many properties, could be many ways. Modes depend for their identities on the substances of which they are modes. One important motivation in the late medieval period for talk of modes, as distinct from accidents, stems from the role accidents were thought to play in the Eucharist, when consecrated bread and wine are converted into the body and blood of Christ. On the accepted view, when this happens, the substance of the bread and wine are not transformed, we don't have a formal change in the Aristotelian sense, but converted, whatever that means, that is transubstantiated into the body and blood of Christ. But the accidents survive. The bread and wine, These substances are no longer present, but their accidents remain, inhering in no substance. Accidents thus capable of independent existence, we call real accidents. Real accidents, a technical term, and could be seen as medieval precursors of Williams's tropes. I hate it when contemporary philosophers describe medieval views, Abelard or whomever, as holding trope views. Right? Trope is a 20th century notion, and it has a very definite place. And to describe that, this is anachronistic in the extreme, I think. When they meant accidents, they were talking about accidents. They were talking about individual accidents. Let's just use that term, or mode. Those are the terms they use. Let's not import a stupid 20th century label. I mean, why did Williams use the term trope instead of accident, right? Because he wanted a bundle theory, and there weren't any obvious historical precedents. So he used the term trope because one of his predecessors at Harvard, Santayana, had used the word trope. Santayana used the word trope to mean universal. So what Williams is looking for is a term that nobody else has used. He could have called them blicks, right? He wants a term that nobody else has used. So he used the term trope, and he meant by the first definition for trope in the OED is a term used in a way other than that originally intended. So the trope is a trope, okay? So it's a joke. And to hear philosophers who don't understand this joke ascribing to the medievals belief in tropes drives me up the wall. So anyway, just a short little preachy moment there, Trump-like moment. The bread and the wine, these substances are no longer present, but their accidents remain, and these are the real accidents. As noted, modes are separable from substances of which they are modes only in thought. You can consider a tomato's color without considering the tomato. But if its color is a mode, you cannot separate the tomato's color from the tomato. This is a form of what E.J. Lowe calls rigid existential dependence. Lowe distinguishes such dependence from non-rigid dependence associated with universals of the sort defended by David Armstrong. So for Armstrong, universals have to have instances, right? But they don't rigidly depend on any of their particular instance. They just have to have some instance or other. Whereas Socrates' paleness needs Socrates. Because a mode owes its identity to the substance it modifies, modes are not transferable. A mode cannot migrate from one substance to another. When the fire's heat warms a pot, the heat does not move from the fire to the pot. The momentum, or a portion of the momentum of one billiard ball, is not transmitted to the other when the first strikes the second. Efficient causation must be otherwise explicable. I've said that, for Descartes, a person is a substance, a particular conscious thinking being, intimately related to a particular body, but capable of independent existence. Contrast this conception of persons with what I take to be Locke's. A person, for Locke, is not a substance. I read Locke as neutral on the question whether there are immaterial substances or souls. But even if there are souls, souls are not to be identified with persons. Persons are particular ways substances are. Persons are modes. And if persons are modes, there's no reason a single substance could not harbor more than one person. Just as a tomato can have many modes, a particular shape, a particular color, a particular mass, a particular momentum, so a single substance could be many persons. Here I am thinking of Locke's example of Castor and Pollux. And that's the first, on the handout, the first one that I'm going to discuss. This is a quotation from Locke. Suppose the soul of Castor separated during his sleep from his body to think apart. Let us suppose, too, that it chooses for its scene of thinking the body of another man, e.g., Pollux, who is sleeping without a soul. For if Castor's soul can think while Castor is asleep, what Castor is never conscious of, it is no matter what place it chooses to think in. This is so Locke. We have here, then, the bodies of two men with only one soul between them. which we will suppose to sleep and wake by turns, the soul still thinking in the waking man, of which the sleeping man is never conscious, never has the least perception. I ask, then, whether Castor and Pollux, thus, with only one soul between them, which thinks and perceives, in one what the other is never conscious of, nor concerned for, are not two as distinct persons as Castor and Hercules, or Socrates and Plato were. Okay, so I take Locke here to be distinguishes his view from Descartes. For Descartes, a person is a substance. For Locke, it's not a substance. Later in the essay, Locke dwells on the distinction between the identity of a substance and the identity of persons or selves. Locke uses these terms interchangeably, persons and selves. My interest here is not in the details of Locke's conception of personal identity, but in his insistence that personal identity is not a species of substantial identity. Locke is willing to allow, at least for the sake of argument, that persons are housed in simple immaterial substances, Cartesian souls. But as the Castor and Pollux case illustrates, one and the same soul could accommodate distinct persons. Locke's focus is on consciousness and on the succession of conscious states that make up our conscious lives. Although persons for Locke are not substances, it is not quite right to say that persons are modes. Persons are potentially intermittent successions of modes, connected by the contents of memories. But again, for purposes of the present discussion, the details of Locke's view are not what matters, only his rejection of the Cartesian conception of persons as substances. You might suspect that I am softening you up for a straightforward Locke-inspired account of the Trinity. God is a single substance, and the three persons are modes of this substance. One difficulty, is that Locke does not countenance the concurrent presence of two or more selves or persons in a single substance. Why not? If consciousness is the source of personhood, and if consciousness is a mode or a succession of modes, what is to prevent a single substance from encompassing several persons? The color of a tomato is a mode, a particular way that tomato is, but the tomato's being this way does not preclude its being many other ways. The tomato, in addition to being colored, has a shape, a size, a mass. One substance, multiple modes. The problem is that, although a substance can indeed be multiply modified, a substance can be many different ways. A substance's being a way of a particular kind precludes it simultaneously being another way of that kind. Suppose a tomato is spherical. The tomato is the spherical way. This does not prevent the tomato from being green, one substance more than one way, more than one mode, but the tomato's being spherical does preclude its being cubical, and the tomato's being green all over does prevent its from being red all over. Of course, a green tomato can become red, and a spherical tomato could come to have another shape, but the tomato can't have two shapes or two colors at once. This is how Locke is thinking about persons. If a person is a mode or a succession of modes, a substance, thus modified, could not at the same time be a distinct person, could not at the same time be differently modified along the conscious dimension. Modes of consciousness are, in this respect, like modes of shape or color. You might take issue with this idea, but I shall not. You might accept that a single substance could be consciously modified so as to count as distinct persons, split brain stuff or whatever. Yeah. Ironically, my colleague, who has devoted her life to split brain cases, argues that the best view of the split brain case is there's one person and two and multiple minds. So, but I'm not going there anyway. So, you might take issue with this idea, but I shall not. You might accept that a single substance could be consciously modified so as to count as distinct persons. That would open the way for an easy route to an account of the Trinity. To be sure, an account that others would find deeply flawed in one or another respect. I propose instead to return to a theme I associated at the outset with Descartes. My hope is that looking a little more deeply at Descartes' official metaphysical picture will point toward a more interesting approach to the Trinity. Recall the basic Cartesian scheme of substance, attribute, and mode. Kinds of substance are distinguished by their attributes. Some substances are extended, some think. A substance is identified with its attribute. An extended substance is its extension, for instance. But anything extended must be extended in some way. Ways of being extended, modes of extension, are what could be regarded as properties of material substances, shape, size, color, texture, those kinds of things. For Descartes, every property of a material substance is a mode of extension, a way of being extended, a geometrical way. This appears, on the face of it, highly unlikely, given the course of post-Cartesian physics, however. Descartes' physics is purely kinematic, purely geometrical, leaving no place for mass, for instance, or charge, neither of which are plausibly regarded as geometrical characteristics of material bodies. If these are modes, they are apparently modes of distinct attributes. But if a substance is its attribute, how could a substance be multiply attributed? This would seem to make no sense. Now, of course, if you go to general relativity, you might have something that looks more Cartesian, but let's not go there today. One philosopher who thought that it did make sense, that is to have one substance multiply attributed in the Cartesian sense, was Spinoza. For Spinoza, in many ways, a good Christian, there is but one substance, God, or nature, the universe as a whole. This one substance, however, is multiply, indeed infinitely attributed. The substance is extended and thinks. What you and I would regard as material bodies, particles, billiard balls, human beings, planets, are modes of extension, not substances, or composites made up of substances. As noted earlier, there is a way of reading Descartes according to which his conception of extended substance was similar. There are many material immaterial substances, but only one extended substance. What interests me here is not Spinoza's monism, however, or the possibility that there is but one extended material substance, but Spinoza's conception of substance as being multiply attributed. For Descartes, a substance is its attribute. For Spinoza, a single substance can be extended and think, and much else besides. A single substance can be extended in various ways and conscious in various ways all at the same time. Modes are ways a substance is what it is, and attributes are what a substance is. Just as colors and shapes or masses and charges do not exclude one another, so modes of distinct attributes do not exclude one another. Your being pale excludes your being dark, but does not exclude your being tall. Your being tall and pale does not exclude your thinking of Vienna. Those are at best analogies, however, because they are modes of the same attribute. You can see where this is going. Well, if you've followed it so far, you might be able to see where this is going, maybe. Start with the idea that persons are not substances, but modes. This allows for a single substance to be distinct persons, but not concurrently. So we're with Locke here, saying Locke doesn't work. Suppose, however, you followed Spinoza and allowed that a single substance could be multiply attributed. And suppose you thought of the Christian God in this way, one substance triply attributed, three Cartesian or Spinoza-style attributes. Three modes, each a way of having a particular attribute. Three persons. Ta-da! I should probably just stop there, but unfortunately I will not do that. I am completely confident that everyone in this room has already thought of at least five reasons this could not possibly provide an adequate account of the Trinity, but I knew that already. I am skeptical that there could be an account, or at least a clear account, that would satisfy all parties. There's an awful lot of in some sensing in papers on the Trinity. In some sense, this is so and so on. And I think these are ways of weaseling out of actually having to say, put your cards on the table. What I propose to do in the remainder of this paper is to address one line of objection, fully aware that this opens the door to a family of objections from the opposite direction. This would be worrisome were my aim to convince you that I have figured out the Trinity, but I have no such ambition. Rather, my goal is to show how certain traditional metaphysical categories comport with discussions of the Trinity. One worry you might have about the idea that the persons of the Trinity are ways God has of having three distinct attributes is that this threatens to trifurcate God, to endow God with a kind of split personality. God would seemingly comprise three centers of consciousness, albeit consciousness of very different kinds, corresponding to differences in the attributes. But these could know of the existence and activities of the others only by external, third-person observation. We have the three, but in having the three, we apparently lose the unity essential to the Christian God. This appears to be an instance of a previously mentioned dilemma that dogs accounts of the Trinity. On the one hand, you need diversity, three distinct persons, one begetting the second, the third proceeding from the first two, or the first one, or whatever. On the other hand, you need unity, one God. Moves that satisfy the first frustrate the second, and vice versa. I believe I can obtain unity, but in doing so, I realize this will raise doubts concerning distinctness. In his discussion of attributes and modes, Descartes appeals to a scholastic classification of kinds of distinction. Really, this comes from Suarez. First, there are real distinctions. Now we're on the handout. I have the three kinds of distinction that I'm going to be discussing. First, these are technical notions, a real distinction. A and B are really distinct, just in case A and B are distinct substances. So when Descartes argues for the real distinction between mind and body, he's arguing that minds and bodies are distinct substances. That's the thrust of the argument for the real distinction. For Spinoza, if A and B are really distinct, each of A and B is conceived through itself, and A and B can exist apart, something possible only for substances. Second, there are what you might call purely conceptual distinctions. And these are distinctions of reasoning reason. And that's the second distinction on the handout. A and B can each be conceived through itself, but A and B are not really distinct, and the distinction has no foundation in reality. It's an unfounded distinction. Conceptual distinction without foundations. In discussing distinctions of reasoning reason, Suarez gives as an example, Peter is Peter, distinguishing Peter from himself. Peter can be distinguished from himself in thought, but the distinction has no basis in reality. Or maybe, you know, Hesperus and Phosphorus. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's a case of a distinction of reasoning reason. Finally, there is an intermediate class of distinction, and this is the distinction of reasoned reason. A and B, when you have a distinction of reasoned reason, then what you have is A and B, each being conceived through itself. Although A and B are not really distinct, they're not distinct substances, the distinction has a foundation. It's founded in reality. Okay, it is. Picking up on something in reality. Suarez explains distinctions of reasoned reason in this way, and this is the quotation that follows the listing of the three distinctions. The other kind of mental distinction arises from inadequate concepts of one and the same thing. Although the same object is apprehended in each concept, the whole reality contained in the object is not adequately represented, nor is its entire essence and objective notion exhausted by either of them. This occurs frequently when we conceive an object in terms of its bearing on different things. Here, such a distinction invariably has a foundation in fact, even though formally it will be said to spring from inadequate concepts of the same thing. Thus, in God, we distinguish his justice from his mercy, because we do not conceive the sublimity, simple virtue of God, as it is in sublimely simple virtue of God as it is in itself, and according to it to the full range of its energy. In summary, Things said to be thus distinct are real entities, or rather a single real entity conceived according to various aspects. The same is evident from the fact that reason does not produce the entities it thus distinguishes, but merely conceives things that are not distinct as though they were distinct. Hence, it is not the objects distinguished, but only the distinction itself that results from the reasoning. So this is not a mind-dependent. The distinction itself, as just as in the case of traditional notion of abstraction itself is a mental operation, but what's abstracted is not itself mind-dependent or subjective in any way. For Descartes, the distinction between a substance and its principal attribute is a distinction of this kind, he says so explicitly, a distinction of reason to reason. The substance and attribute cannot exist apart. A material substance is its extension. An immaterial substance is its thinking. But the distinction reflects an important feature of reality, the distinction between a something and what that something is. Spinoza, too, accepts the substance attribute distinction as one of reason to reason. Now we have a complication, however. Unlike Descartes, Spinoza holds that a substance can have infinitely many attributes. Each of these is distinguished from the substance of which it is an attribute by reason to reason. If a substance is extended and is thinking, its extension and its thinking are distinguished from it, the substance, by reason to reason. But how are the various attributes related? How are they distinguished from one another? Okay, suppose A and B are attributes of a substance S. The distinction between A and S, between one attribute A and the substance, and between B and S, each of those distinctions is one of reason to reason. Not a real distinction, but still a distinction founded in reality. What of the distinction between A and B? Okay, so how are they related? Given that A and B are attributes, not substances, the distinction in A and B could not be a real distinction. And given that S is the substance is A and S the substance is B, it is hard to see how it could fail to turn out that A is B. Okay. So the distinction between A and B. So is the distinction between A and B one of reasoning reason? That's the non-founded distinction. A purely conceptual distinction lacking a foundation in reality? Before addressing this question, let me remind you that I have suggested that it might be possible to understand the Trinity as a case of a single substance triply attributed, where the three persons of the Trinity are understood as modes, albeit modes of distinct attributes. The initial worry was that this threatens God's unity. Perhaps this worry was misplaced. Thus, suppose the distinction among attributes is not merely one of reasoning reason, the morning star, evening star, Peter and Peter distinction, but one of reasoned reason. This would provide an underlying unity coupled with a kind of diversity that reflects an important aspect of reality. Put somewhat unhelpfully, the attributes are distinct expressions of a single underlying nature. I realize that this is all much too vague, but I think it might be possible to make sense of it. Doing so will require temporarily moving away from the theological context. Although not a player in contemporary analytic metaphysics, a substance attribute mode ontology holds many attractions. Consider the Cartesian idea that kinds of substance are distinguished by their attributes. Extended substances are distinguished from thinking substances. Substances' properties are modes, fully determinate ways of being attributed, particular ways of substances being the substances they are. Properties of material substances are modes of extension, ways of being extended. Properties of immaterial substances are modes of thought, ways of thinking or being conscious. This makes the inherence relation, a relation between the tomato's shape, for instance, or its color, and the tomato, an internal relation. You could not have this very shape or this very color without having the tomato, because it's a way that the tomato is extended, let's say. Properties are not glued onto their bearers. There are ways of being those bearers, and every bearer, every substance, must be some way or other. Now, that's the Cartesian model, where we're assuming one attribute per substance, right? An obvious difficulty for the Cartesian view, however, is that it is implausible that every property of a material substance is a mode of extension. An electron might be thought to have a determinate shape and size and a determinate location, but electrons have an addition, mass and charge. And mass and charge seem not to be modes of extension, seem not to be ways of being extended. Suppose, however, you thought of particles as multiply attributed on the Spinozistic model. A particle, such as an electron, is extended, but it is also massive and charged. Its properties would be modes of these attributes. Particles of other kinds are distinguished from electrons by virtue of being different mass-wise or different charge-wise. Some particles altogether lack these attributes and possess others. This makes sense, but now you lose one of the features that makes the original Cartesian view so elegant. For Descartes, a material object is its extension, and its properties are just determinate ways it is extended. And it's got to be extended in some ways or other, right? There is no asking why a given body is extended. In creating a material body, God creates an extended thing, a something extended in various ways. Now, however, it looks as though God must not only create the bodies, but also allocate attributes across those bodies. Some are massive, some are not. Some are charged, some are not. This is not merely a change in detail, it's a much bigger deal. Suppose, however, that the attributes turned out to be unified. Suppose the distinction between mass and charge, for instance, turned out to be one of reason to reason. Something like this is what physics aims for in seeking a theory that unifies the forces. If there were such a theory, the forces would be unified at a deep level. The distinction among them, however, would not merely be one of reasoning reason, wouldn't just be unfounded, would not be merely conceptual, it would be one of reasoned reason, one founded on the way reality is and appears to us. Okay, here's a quotation from Spinoza, and this is the last quotation. It is evident that although two attributes may be conceived to be really distinct, that is, one may be conceived without the aid of the other, we still cannot infer from that that they constitute two beings or two different substances. For it is the nature of a substance that each of its attributes is conceived through itself, since all the attributes it has have always been in it together, and one could not be produced by another, but each expresses the reality or being of a substance. If this is right, or sort of right, or something, not only would it support an elegant substance attribute mode ontology, it would provide an independently motivated, non-theological base for understanding how the persons of the Trinity could be unified yet distinct. One substance, three immutable attributes, each expressing the nature of the substance in a distinctive way. I leave it others to judge just how unlikely it is such a view could accommodate the Father's begetting the Son and the Spirit's proceeding from the Father and the Son, or the Father alone, or whatever. I will retire from the field and leave the topic in the hands of others who actually know something about it. Thank you very much.